We're going to be in chapters 32, 33, 34 today. And we're going to focus on Moses. And we're focusing on the relationship in these three chapters that he had with God, like a relationship of no other character that we see in the Bible. So we'll go there. We'll start in chapter 32 because we got to get him off the mountain. We got to get him back up the mountain and get him off the mountain again. Oh, also, before I forget about it, Roarbacks up here on the corner has 10 limes for a dollar. I brought a box. It's on the back counter, and you can have 20 limes for zero. All right, so take limes home with you today. There's bags and everything. Chapter 32, verse 24 is where I want to start. Moses has come down off the mountain. God has come to him and says, you had better get down off the mountain because the Israelites are doing crazy stuff and I'm not happy. Get down there and take care of the people right now. Moses heads down the mountain, picks up Joshua at whatever waypoint Joshua was, heads back to camp. Here's the commotion. Joshua thinks perhaps there's been some type of battle and we're listening to a victory celebration. Moses knows otherwise, obviously, because God has talked to him, for one thing. But in chapter 32, verse 24, when he confronts Aaron about all the things that happened and what's going on, and I said to them, this is Aaron speaking, whoever has gold, let them break it off. So they gave it to me, and I cast it into the fire, and this calf came out. What? Did it? Look back in verse 3, I think. Verse 4, I'm sorry. Well, let's go to 3. Same chapter, verse 3. So all the people broke off their golden earrings, which were in their ears, and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool. And he made a molded calf. Then they said, this is your God, O Israel, that they brought you out of the land of Egypt. Aaron just plain lied, didn't he? I mean, he passed the buck. I don't know what happened, God. I don't know what happened, Moses. I threw some gold in the fire and this thing just came out. That's a seven-year-old story. You know, that is the worst of dog ate my homework kind of stuff. And Moses is not buying it, and Aaron knows better. Verse 25, now when Moses saw that the people were unrestrained, for Aaron had not restrained them, to their shame amongst their enemies, then it really gets serious. Fran, I saw your hand. I'll come right back to you. What's going on with these people? Unrestrained. Do you know what the word means? Pardon?
Naked.
Betty's version says, and the people were naked. Without clothing? You know, in the South, there's two different things. There's naked and then there's naked. And there is a difference between the two. These people, this is an orgy. That's what's going on. There's an orgy. The people are reveling wild and crazy. Fran, you have a question?
Yes, Moses was a leader, but Aaron sounds like a follower.
Well, Moses and Aaron both have made mistakes. Fran's comment is that Moses was a leader and Aaron sounds like a follower. Yeah, I mean, I know where you're coming from. Aaron was unwilling to face the people and tell them what needed to be told. He went with the flow. He did which was convenient and expedient in that circumstance. It was a mistake, obviously. And because of this, there's going to be some people that are going to lose their life. Because what does Moses then do regarding taking care of this particular incident? The old proverbial line in the sand is drawn. And Moses says, okay, look, I need you to either be with me or be against me. What did the Levites do? They came over and stepped over the line and joined Moses. And then what did Moses have them do? There was some punishment to be exacted. They took the sword, and on that day about 3,000 of their own Israelite brothers were killed. Because why? Because there was evil done in the camp. What's been the number one instruction to the Israelites, almost from the word go, regarding keeping themselves pure? What is the very first commandment? You shall have no other gods before me. What did they do here? They built another god. What does it matter about what their enemies thought? Because in verse 25, when we were just reading, for Aaron had not restrained them to their shame amongst their enemies. What's important there about that?
God looked weak.
Okay, Helen's comment is, I'll sum it up with the last statement, it makes God look weak. And it does. How do they now look in the sight of those who are watching? As if though, you know, they have no self-control. And what good is an army with no self-control and no discipline? What's going to happen? Well, what's their job? What's their mission, their charter? What have they been told they're going to do? They're going to go into the promised land and they're going to take it. God's going to go in before them. He's going to clear a trail, plow some ground up, but they're going to go in there and do it and finish it, and He's going to be with them. As those people that are around them have seen what God has done in Egypt, as He's taken them out of there, and they've seen how God has humbled Egypt, what do they now see with how the Israelites are acting amongst themselves? This is a big deal. Obviously, Moses thought so. Obviously, God thought so. And what did the Israelites have problems with for all the years that we read of them? Do you remember Balaam? And Balaam, he was requested to speak against God, and he wouldn't do it. You remember also that Balaam was not a good guy. He did God's job in that particular instance. He also told the king how eventually Israel would fall, even though he wouldn't speak of them in that particular circumstance, and it was going to be because of sexual immorality and not keeping themselves pure and away from the other countries, because those countries would become a snare and were a snare. What's our lesson for us in keeping our lives pure as we go through our daily walk? How many things are out there that can snare us and pull us in? How many situations can we put ourselves in which we do not give ourselves a chance to succeed? And it happens all the time. Verse 35. So the Lord plagued the people because of what they did with the calf which Aaron made. How? How? How'd they get plagued? Is this referring to something specific or in general terms with what was going to happen over the next 40 years? I can find no reference to an actual something specific. I think God is simply telling us that this was the start. On the front end of this covenant, there were problems because of the Israelites. There's going to continue to be problems. And as we go through the next however many years, they're going to continue to have to pay the consequences for their sins. And do they? Each and every time? They do. All right, chapter 33. I'm not sure that when it comes to the relationship that God has with Moses, or said the other way around, the relationship that Moses has with God, there's a more important chapter than this one, 33. And I really want to focus on, I want us to keep that in our minds as we're looking at this and think about that relationship, because it is a tremendous relationship that I would challenge you to find someone who has an equal of it. I was discussing this week, and Bill Jr. said to me, well, I'll throw one other name out there, and that's Elijah. Because Elijah was taken up to heaven in a whirlwind. Fiery chariot? Oh, I don't know why I said whirlwind. Whirlwind, fiery chariot. You know, probably the chariot was going round and round when he went up. And Elijah appeared at the Transfiguration with who? Moses. Okay? So I had to grant that. I had to agree with my brother-in-law in that particular circumstance that he had made a valid point. I think, based on what we know, because we don't know much about Elijah's life, and we know a ton about Moses' life. And there are some things that we know about Moses that don't appear to be relevant to Elijah. But regardless of all that, you could take the people who had the relationship with God that Moses had and count them on one finger or two fingers. I mean, it was incredibly special. So let's just keep that in mind. What did God, in the first verse of chapter 33, tell Moses to do? Depart and go up from here, you and the people, whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt, to the land which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, to your descendants I will give it. Now, if you just pull this one verse out of context, it looks like God's saying, okay, you messed up, well, let's just keep on going forward. We got a land to take over. Keep reading, because that's not the case. God is extremely upset, and he lets Moses know such. Verse 3, go up to a land flowing with milk and honey, for I will not go up in your midst, lest I consume you on the way, for you are a stiff-necked people. Well, we know the rest of the story. Did God go with the Israelites? And he did. What's he telling Moses here? I'm sick of you. I'm tired of you. You've acted the fool. I am not going to be part of this. Moses, it's on you. You take them. Head of the promised land. I'm not going to be with you. I can't tell you who the 3,000 were. Those, as I look through this, there was retribution. There were consequences for those who worshiped the golden calf and took part in the whole exercise of turning Israel to the golden calf. I can't answer that question. Those 3,000 were obviously 3,000 who did evil in God's sight. Okay? And the Levites carried out the execution. Fran's comment is about God's grace to undeserving people, both in terms of the Israelites and in terms of us today, which is absolutely true. The Israelites did everything wrong you could possibly do when it comes to a relationship with God. Yet, what did God not do? Turn his back on them, destroy them. Now, in verse 3 of chapter 33, he says, I'm not going with you. Okay? We know that he went. What had to happen for him in order to change his mind? That man Moses is going to have a conversation with him. Can you think of anyone in Scripture who is able to sit down with God and have this kind of discussion about things as important as who lives and who dies? What did God tell Moses at the end of chapter 32? I'm going to kill him. I'm going to kill them all. Moses, let me start over. I'll make a great nation out of you. And Moses says, God, no, please, don't do it. You know, we're a stiff-necked people, but we're going to do our best. That's not necessary. God's still mad here. He is not taking lightly what they've done when he's gone up on the mountain. Can you understand why? Have you ever told your kids not to do something? Had a long discussion about it to which the kids absolutely, positively understood what you were talking about. Said, "Dad, I get it. I get it. I understand." And 5 minutes after you left the house, they did it again. And you, when you left the house, you knew that finally you had broken through. You had got it. They understood it. They were smart. You know, you looked at your wife and as you were driving down the street and you said, "Honey, they finally understood me. They finally got it." And then what happened as soon as you hit the stop sign and turned left? Well, here we go again. Well, that's them. Less than 40 days after we get all these instructions, they're dancing around a gold calf in the camp. And God says, "I'm not doing this anymore. I am not going with you or them anywhere. You're on your own. Go." Look down in verse 4. "And when the people heard this bad news, they mourned, and no one put on their ornaments." A little remorse? Do we see instances of the Jews displaying remorse in all instances, in all these cases? Yes. Every time they were remorseful. I think the biggest issue they had was Alzheimer's, because they had absolutely zero short-term memory. And I said that lightly and perhaps a bit cavalier, because that's not a funny diagnosis, and I know that. But why can't they get it? They were upset. They didn't put on their ornaments. And what? What's their ornaments? You know what I was talking about? You remember that scripture that was on the tip of my head in just Matthew chapter 23? They broadened, it's talking about the scribes, Jesus is talking about the scribes and the Pharisees broadening their phylacteries and enlarging the hems of their garments. This word here, ornaments, has to do with that, their finest dress. Their probably specifically headdresses is what it's referring to, but those things that they would put on when there would be a great celebration. So they didn't do that. In other words, they tucked their heads down, slumped their shoulders. They recognized that this was not a good thing. God was upset with them. Verse 7. "Moses took his tent and pitched it outside the camp, far from the camp, and he called it the Tabernacle of Meeting. And it came to pass that everyone who sought the Lord went out to the Tabernacle of Meeting, which was outside the camp. So it was, whenever Moses went out to the tabernacle, that all the people rose, and each man stood at his tent door, and he watched Moses until he had gone into the tabernacle." Now, is this the tabernacle that we've got instructions for? Hadn't been built yet, okay? This is a temporary tabernacle. Moses took it outside the camp, set it up so that he could talk to God, commune with God, get instructions, etc., and so forth. "And it came to pass when Moses entered the tabernacle that the pillar of cloud descended and stood at the door of the tabernacle, and the Lord talked with Moses. And all the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the tabernacle door, and all the people rose and worshiped, each man in his own door." They recognized what was going on when Moses set up the tent outside the camp. The fact that they saw Moses walk by and they got up and worship at their own door indicates some amount of Repentance. However you want to look at it, recognizing that they have done wrong and need to make things right. Verse 11, though, is a verse that I need you to star, highlight, think about, recognize. Because if this does not sum up the relationship that God had with Moses and Moses had with God, then I'm not sure what does. "So the Lord spoke to Moses face to face, as a man speaks to his friend." Let that sink in. We have that kind of relationship with God. Moses and the Lord talked face to face And God spoke with Moses as a man speaks to his friend. What kind of conversations do we have with our friends? Are they formal and stuffy? Are they easy and embodying the relationship that we have with that friend? How does the conversation change the more the person is a true friend versus just an acquaintance? Pardon? Fran's comment is it becomes comfortable and natural and a very easy thing.
It's from the heart, too.
Oh, it is from the heart. If I'm having a conversation with someone I don't know that well, am I going to empty anything out if I need assistance? Am I going to talk about those things that are dearest and nearest to me or important in such a manner that I would with my dad or with another brother or with that really, really, really close personal friend? And this is that kind of relationship that God and Moses had. It's kind of unusual, isn't it? I mean, we talk about, well, he was my dad, but he's also my best friend. If we have that really good relationship with our father. And Moses really did have that relationship. Pretty awesome. Pretty awesome. And I did not use that word lightly, because we're going to talk about that word awesome here in just a little bit, too. Verses 12 through 33. Now get back to verse 3. Because in verses 12 through 33, after we get this picture in verse 11 of the relationship that Moses has with God, Moses has a conversation with God that is kind of hard to believe. It is personal. It is challenging. It is all those things that at some point you sit back and you look and you think, did he just say that to God? And God doesn't appear to take offense to it. That's why verse 11 is so important. And that's why it tells us just exactly what this relationship is that Moses had with God. Because 12 through 23, let's look. Then Moses said to the Lord, "See, you say to me, bring up this people. But you have not let me know whom you will send with me. Yet you have said, I know you by your name, and have also found grace in my sight. Now therefore I pray, if I have found grace in your sight, show me now your way, that I may know you and that I find grace in your sight. And consider that this nation is your people." And God said, "My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest." Moses does not stop, though. He said to God, "If your presence does not go with us, do not bring us up from here." What's he saying? Hey, kill us all right now, right here. If you're not going with us, we cannot do the job. There is no point, there is no sense, there is nothing to be gained from us leaving here if you're not going to be with us. Pretty bold statement to be saying to God. "For how then will it be known that your people and I have found grace in your sight except you go with us? So we shall be separate, your people and I, from all the people who are upon the face of the earth." So the Lord said to Moses, "I will also do this thing that you have spoken, for you have found grace in my sight and I know you by name." Moses does not stop. He says in verse 18, "Please show me your glory." Verse 19, God said, this is God talking, "I will make all my goodness pass before you. I will proclaim the name of the Lord before you. I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion." But he said, "You cannot see my face, for no man shall see me and live." And the Lord said, "Here is a place by me, and you shall stand on this rock. So it shall be while my glory passes by that I will put you in the cleft of the rock and I will cover you with my hand while I pass by." then I will take away my hand, and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen. Pretty awesome, isn't it? Fran? Fran's comment is he demanded this from God, and he did. And that's what makes this conversation so special and so powerful and in some ways such a head scratcher. Can you imagine anyone being able to talk to God in this way? Because make no mistake about it, he's come off that mountain, he's seen what the people have done. God has says, I'm not going another step with you. And Moses is going in and saying, you've got to. You have to go. You've made me promises. You have told me what you're going to do, and now you're backing out? It can't happen that way. We cannot go on before. We cannot go on without you. Furthermore, I need to see some proof you're going to be with me. That's the conversation, Mike. All right, I don't know if everybody could hear that, but it was an excellent comment. The comment started with the fact that Moses starts off the book by being reluctant and using the excuse, I am not eloquent of speech. And now here is Moses standing before God in a situation where he's pretty eloquent. And having the nerve and the courage and the conviction and the faith to talk to God in this way. And I think that is an excellent point. Did I summarize it good, Mike? Is that good? All right. Steve? And that's common. Steve's comment is when Moses says, remember, these are your people. That conversation has gone back and forth a lot. Your people. Your people. Remember when they first came out of Egypt, Moses said, do you really want for the rest of the world to see how weak your people are by not... We did all these great things to Egypt. Now we're a mess and you're going to abandon us and not, you know, show those people what you did. You humbled Egypt. We got other people to humble too. Cain.
I think the promise of God to lead us.
Did you hear Cain's comment? That's so true. How do we get into a position where we feel like God needs us more than we need Him? I don't know how we get there. We push God further away. We turn inside to ourselves. We become moral relativists. We don't recognize that there is an authority or the power of God, that there is a Creator, and so we depend more on self than Him. I guess that's how we get there. But that's what happens. Yeah, yeah, we get to the point where we think we don't need Him. Or the roles are reversed, as Frayne was, Cain was talking about. See, I did it again. Frayne. Frayne and Can. Gary? Yes. Oh, I'm trying to think of how to summarize what Gary just said so everybody could hear it. It was all a good comment. We'll go with his last part. He said, pray on the little days so you know how to pray on the big days. I mean, that, how true is that? We get this relationship with God. It's not a relationship. Sometimes as children, we just want what we want for selfish reasons. And that's not what builds a relationship, is it? Okay. Verse 34. What's Moses have to do now? What does God tell him to do? Cut some more stone? Make some more tablets? Come back up on the mountain? Why is he going back up? What happened in the first set? Broke it, didn't he? How long is he up on the mountain this time? How long was he up there the first time? 40 days, 40 nights. He's going back up there for another 40 days and 40 nights. Okay? You reckon there's a test in that as to how long he's going to stay gone the second time? Verse 4. So he cut two tablets of stone like the first ones. Then Moses rose up early in the morning and went up to the Mount Sinai as the Lord had commanded. And he took in his hand the two stones. The Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. And the Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abounding in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgressions and sin, by no means clearing the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generations. So Moses made haste and bowed his head towards the earth and worshiped. Then he said, if now I have found grace in your sight, O Lord, let my Lord, I pray, go amongst us, even though we are a stiff-necked people. Pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us as your inheritance. He's been there, done this before. He's cut these stones once before. God has written on the stones once before. He goes back up on the mountains after having a wonderful conversation with God. But he recognizes that God is God, and he bows and he asks for forgiveness for coming up there on the mountain with him where he was invited to go on behalf of those stiff-necked people. Moses never abandons his own people, the same way that God never abandons his people. They have conversations back and forth about whether or not these people are really deserving of all that they're getting, but neither abandons them. Verse 10, God is going to declare a covenant. He says, behold, I make a covenant before all your people. I will do marvels such as you have not, such as not have not been done in all the earth, nor in any nation. And all the people among whom you are shall see the work of the Lord, for it is an awesome thing that I will do with you. I've got New King James. Your version may say terrible there. I think King James says terrible. I think American Standard, or New American Standard, says terrible. The word there is Yahweh, is the way it's pronounced. Yaw-ray with the emphasis on the ray. The word does mean fear, frightening, to revere in a moral sense. Whether or not terrible is maybe the best translation as to how we use the word today, I'm not sure. But I want to get on a little bit of a soapbox for just 30 seconds and talk about how the Scripture describes God in God's own Word. For it is an awesome thing that I do for you. I will myself occasionally slip and call something awesome. I'm not sure that's a good idea for me to do that. God describes Himself as awesome. How many other things could be? Mike's point of the definition is without equal. This week, the Oxford College Dictionary came out with their new version. And they listed several words that are new in the dictionary for the very first time. Do you know what one of those words was? Can you guess? Has something to do with awesome? There is now a word in the Oxford Dictionary called, or the word is awesome sauce. It's a word. All because of that stupid Discover Card commercial or whatever it is. Probably the word didn't come from there on the commercial. Obviously the word's been around. But the Oxford College Dictionary now has a word, awesome sauce. One word, no hyphen, no spaces between the letters. All right, enough. If it would have been the Urban Dictionary, I would have understood it. But this should be, I mean, this is a book that our kids take to college in order to get some degree of higher learning. And we have a word in it called awesome sauce. I'm going back to Exodus chapter 33, verse 10, and I'm going to say, I better not be caught using that word awesome sauce. And I've used it because I thought the commercial was funny, and every once in a while something will happen, and I've occasionally said it. I've got to be careful. I also have to be careful using the word awesome to describe anything man-made. Is it a sin? I can't go that far. Is this IRO in Richard's opinion? Yes. But, I mean, there's a certain amount of truth I'm spouting out here as to how we look at these things. And when we have our description of God, how we keep God awesome. And we don't keep God awesome by bringing Him down to our level and desensitizing ourselves to Him on human terms. Anyway, that was free. Verses 12 through 17 of chapter 34. Got to get caught back up here. These are our scriptures regarding keeping themselves pure. Again, God tells the Israelites, you cannot let yourself get sucked in with all the snares and the traps of those people that are around you. You can't do things with them. You can't join with them. All these things are going to take you away from me, and that's not a good thing. Did they listen to him? Did they pay attention? And no, they didn't. What about the firstborn in verse 19? All the firstborn belongs to him. We have this concept again of the first fruits. Either get it or it's redeemed. Okay. Verse 24 I thought was pretty interesting. Remember, God set up three feasts for them. And they're going into the land of Canaan, and they're going to drive out the godless people. God tells them in verse 24, for I will cast out the nations before you, and I will enlarge your borders. Neither will any man covet your land when you go up to appear before the Lord your God three times in the year. What's he telling them? Hey, don't use an excuse of, I've got to make sure I keep my fort protected when it's sacrifice and feast time. In other words, go to church, worship, because nothing bad's going to happen to you while you're there. Now, obviously I can't take that everywhere because right now my house could be robbed. You know, but what is God telling the children about worrying about those people around them during these three godly events? I'm going to keep you safe during these three times. Fret not and focus on me, not on other things, during these times. And that advice certainly does transcend to today, for sure. All right, I think I want to finish Exodus next week with a recap. What I need you to do is write down the point, the one overriding thing that you think you're getting out of this book. And I want a lot of discussion next week, a lot of discussion about what Exodus means to you, okay? I'm not going to leave it all there because just as sure as I do, I'll come in here with no lesson prepared and you will have lockjaw. So I'm not going to take that chance, but I really want you to sit, spend some time, look at the book, think about it, and be prepared to discuss it when we finish it up next week. Helen, face-to-face in terms of direct communication. All right. We're going to talk with God. He communicated directly with him. He was in the same room with him. What do we know, and I didn't even get to it at the end of this chapter, about Moses' shining face, how Moses looked when he came out from the presence of God. But did he literally see his face? No, he did not. Okay, any other questions or comments? The bell has rung, and going once, twice, three times. Thanks.